Welcome back to part two of We Love Movies. Now, earlier on, we played you out our interview with Kurt Russell. Now it is the time for the one and only Dave Bautista, a man whose career has just gone through the stratosphere ever since starring as Drax in the first Guardians of the Galaxy movie, which came out in 2014, because he took a big gamble leaving the WWE back in 2010. He was very successful, but he decided that he wasn't getting the opportunities that he hoped with the organisation and really wanted to pursue acting. And there's a few years where it just really wasn't happening for him. And he'll tell you more when you hear the interview. But my God, is he so busy at the moment. He's in Spectre, as you know. He played Mr. Hinks in that. He's going to be seen in Blade Runner 2049. So many films in the pipeline for him. And it was great to be in his company. A real gentle giant of a man. But before we hear from him, let us play you a little clip of him in action as Drax in Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2.
If I touch someone, I can feel their feelings. You feel love.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, I feel a general unselfish love for just about everybody.
No, sexual love.
No, I don't.
For her.
No.
She just told everyone your deepest, darkest secret.
Dude, come on. I think you're overreacting a little bit.
You must be so embarrassed. Do me.
Dave, good to be in your company.
Good to be in your company.
Man, God, the last few years have been busy for you,
yeah,
sir.
Yeah, in a good way, yeah.
Because Drax, it's not just a career-changing role. And to be honest with you, David, life-changing.
Yeah, absolutely. I've said over and over, it not only changed the path of my career, but even more so changed the path of my life. You know, it's been quite surreal since the first Guardians came out. I've been working nonstop, and it's like a dream come true.
I'm just looking at your IMDb page, all the stuff that you're doing, Dave. Yeah. Like, and you're producing now as well. Like, you're not taking a moment, it seems. But people mightn't realize that when you did leave the WWE, there was that, we'll call it a lean period, wasn't there? Did you ever kind of think to yourself, oh God, did I make the right decision?
Yeah, there was. I never thought that, but it was 3 years of barely working, and they were very lean years because I didn't leave the WWE with movie offers and I didn't really leave with support of the company either. So I kind of left and I was on my own, and it was just scary. And it there came a point where I literally had sold everything that I had. I packed up all my stuff in boxes and I was getting ready to move out to LA. So I could start auditioning more. And I got the call for Guardians, yeah. It was coming in audition, and that was it, man. It was life-changing.
What a role Drax is. Like, for me, like, he's such a great character, and in Volume 2, he steals the show, I think. You know, he's just so funny. Like, going in, did you have an idea of how to play him as such? Because he is so deadpan, he is so irony-free.
Yeah.
Did you know all of that going in, kind of what they were looking for?
No, I didn't. You know, I had somewhat of a sense of it because I worked with an acting coach. He had to introduce me to Drax. I had no idea who Drax was. I had no idea who the Guardians were. And he kind of went, he went over the stuff with me because when I first read it, I was baffled. I just didn't get it at all. I was so confused. And I sent him the side so he could look at it so we could start working on it. He said, this is amazing. Like, this is going to show off your range. This is exactly what you've been looking for. And so when I went in, and then I went in, and I read with Sarah Finn, the casting director, and she asked me to come back the next day to read for James. And as soon as I started working with James, we just clicked. I mean, I just felt so comfortable with him, and he was so, like, easy to work with and very precise in his direction, and I just got it. And luckily enough, I was just kind of what he was looking for.
Great stuff, because I know you were on the junket trail, I think it was in Mexico City, and if I'm right in saying, like, you pulled him aside at one stage and said, like, if we're coming back for a second helping here, how are you going to top this?
Yeah, I did. I remember asking him, and he said, I'm not even going to try, I'm just going to make it completely different. Mm-hmm. It's going to be completely different, and he did. And it, to me, I really like the second film better. Mm-hmm. I just think it's deeper. I think it's more of a roller coaster. I think you just get absorbed into it a bit more. And but I remember asking him that, and he just, without hesitation, he said, I'm not even going to think about it. I'm just going to make it different.
Anticipation now, Dave, is for a third one. You know, I know you guys are busy shooting, you know, Infinity War. He must feel like a parent, like, letting you guys off. It must be very difficult for him to do that.
Yeah, it's weird. It's it was odd for us as well going into Infinity Wars because we didn't know what to expect from the Russo brothers. I was personally a little bit worried that they were going to try to change our characters to make us what they wanted us to be, and it wasn't that case at all. Now, for one, we had the luxury of having James write for us, but two, they just kind of gave us free rein to be ourselves, and they were very encouraging about us being Guardians. They could take us in a different route, different path at all. And they loved that chemistry that the Guardians brought to the Avengers. So they wanted us, they encouraged us to be the guardians that James Gunn created.
Well, just as I was saying earlier, Ron, Dave, your filmography and everything that's coming up, one film in particular I just wanted to talk to you about from an Irish perspective.
Right.
Final Score, which you're also producing. Yeah. Pierce Brosnan is in that as well. And I've had the pleasure of interviewing Pierce over the years, and he's a real gent.
Yeah.
What was it like working with him, and did he have any advice at all from working?
We, you know, it's... We just sat around and talked more about life. Pierce was, you know, I was always a fan of Pierce. I loved him, but I didn't really appreciate him enough until I actually met him. And I think a lot of people will find, he's just such a down-to-earth man's man. He really is. He's a tough, rugged guy, too. And I love him. He said something to me before we parted ways that I'll never forget. And he said, "Dave, be brave, be bold." And I was like, I melted like a little girl.
Thanks, Bond.
But yeah, and he's brilliant. But, you know, we did our first very dramatic scene together, and it was an emotional scene. And it just felt so good. And I stood up, and I just felt really good about myself. I was like, man, I killed this. I was with Pierce Brosnan, I killed this. And I stood up, and I looked, and I said, "Man, thank you so much. It's just, you're absolutely brilliant." And he said, "It's a two-way street."
Oh, wow.
It's a two-way street, you give and you receive, man. And I just love that.
And one final Oh, we're done.
Thanks, man.
That was
fun.
That was great, Dave.
Yeah, thanks,
so good
man.
To meet
yeah,
you,
it was
man.
A pleasure, man.
We love movies with Gordon Hayden.
It's now time to review Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. But before we do, let us play you a little bit from the trailer.
I see it within you. Fear. Jealousy. Betrayal. It is our duty to cleanse the universe of this weakness.
You know, they told me you people were conceited douchebags, but that isn't true at all. Dude.
I'm using my wrong eye.
Good section there from the trailer to Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. Both me and Rory Cashin have seen the film. Rory, there's a lot going on with the plot.
Yeah.
So I'm going to pass the baton to you now to try and condense what is going on.
Okay. Well, Peter Quill is played by Chris Pratt. He and the rest of the Guardians are, you know, kind of renegades for hire, saving the universe whenever they can, but also, you know, stealing stuff whenever they want to. Mm-hmm. And they kind of cross paths with Ego, who is played by Kurt Russell, who announces himself pretty quickly, so it's spoilery, but it's in the first 20 minutes of the film, plus it's in a trailer, so get over it, as being Peter Quill's dad. And he invites him back to his home planet to tell him more about his personal past. Stuff happens there,
mm-hmm.
as does stuff for every other member of the Guardians of the Galaxy group, but, you know, this one is kind of more focused. I think it's fair to say it's more focused on Peter and Ego. That's fair, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so, yeah, because there's a lot of subplots going on, but obviously that is the paramount narrative thread going on. Now, if we rewind the clock just before we get into Volume 2, like, the first film people might forget was a big gamble for Marvel because it was an unproven quantity. It was a particular comic book that only real diehard fans would have known of, and many critics thought this could be Marvel's first big misstep.
Mm-hmm.
But it proved to be a massive success. And also, we have to bear in mind, Chris Pratt wasn't even a big name back then. He was really coming off the back of Parks and Recreation.
Yeah.
So the first film for you, Rory, what did it mean to you?
Well, it goes to show that if you take a risk, like, it can pay off magnificently, because they got this director, James Gunn, who most people only know for being involved in either really violent horror films or writing the Scooby-Doo films, because he did that, Gordon.
That's right, he did, yeah.
And we will never forgive him, and we will never allow him to forget what he did to us. But on the other hand, yeah, there was a, at once, like, chubby television actor, there was the second in command for Avatar, there was a wrestler, two of the most famous people you don't see on the screen, because they're a tree and a raccoon. There was, what's his name, with the arrow and the thing in his head.
Oh, Michael Rooker.
Yes, like, no one really knows who Michael Rooker is outside of, like, real cult diehard film fans. They do now. Like, it was all this, like, it was, from the outside in, it was like, what? Did you just throw, like, darts at a, like, CAA board filled with, like, there's some random actors there, and there's this director, and now everything just goes together, and here's this weird soundtrack from the 70s, and kids won't give, you know, a hell.
A Groot.
A Groot. They won't give a Groot. Thank you very much about, like, 70s music, but it all came together, coalesced. specifically because it was so different to what Marvel had given us before. It was essentially like Marvel's version of Star Wars, which was great.
Yeah, well, it was almost like if Han Solo had written a script for his own space opera, this would be it. Now, going in to Volume 2, where the expectations were so low with the first film, now they are incredibly high.
Yeah.
So people might be thinking, is it going to be more of the same, only cranked up to 11? Or could they follow the Empire Strikes Back route, bearing in mind now there's a father figure? Could this be a darker type of entry? What were you expecting going in?
Like the whole lack of surprise was going to be a major problem, but you would hope, because especially leading up to it, aside from Kurt Russell announcing himself as the dad, we knew that was going to be the big plot point anyway. We didn't really know that much about the film. Like, you see, there's a big action sequence where they're fighting this big tentacle monster thing. That's the opening scene of the film.
Yeah.
Like, they don't give too much away. So going in, I was like, this could literally be about anything. And in the end, it didn't really feel like it was about anything. That was my biggest problem with this film, and reminded me a little bit of Age of Ultron and Iron Man 2, those slightly lesser Marvel sequels where at the start of the film and at the end of the film, nothing has really dramatically changed for anyone in it.
Mm-hmm. That's very true, Rory, because the first half hour just feels like everyone's riffing off of each other. And I love the characters, so being in their company is great. But then when the plot then starts to kick in, the story itself then seems to really grind to a bit of a halt to a degree. It really gets quite sludgy. So many subplots are going on at the same time. The momentum seems lost. And then I almost felt like there was Marvel executives going, right, we've had an awful lot of talking now. Amp up that action.
Yeah.
And the action at times felt so protracted, I became numb by it. Really and truly, I thought maybe they could have cracked this story a lot more if it would be 90 minutes. Because what is it, 2 hours, 20 minutes? And by God, at times it drags.
Yeah, there's a whole bit where Gamora and Nebula are working out their differences, and the way that scene sets itself up is just one of the most clumsily written things I've ever seen. Like, there's a shootout and they fall down a hole, and then they get into a fight, and then they kind of work it out, and then they just kind of, what's that over there? And it's the plot is lying in a cave to their left where they've just accidentally fallen headfirst into it.
Yeah.
And it was just very like, was there no better or natural way to progress the story? Cause it felt like James Gunn had written himself into a bit of a corner. He was like, oh, right, the rest of the film. Okay, and then they find the MacGuffin, and then the film continues on. And then by the end of it, Kurt Russell is really, really good in it, but it's just that CGI blob stuff that happens at the end of kind of poorly thought out Marvel films, where it's just this CGI is fighting that CGI, and there's no emotional weight to any of it.
Just before we get scores, Rory, the poster summed up how I felt about this movie. There's too much going on. It looks like it's about to burst at the seams. And yet everything is amped up. Everything is amped up. And it doesn't look, from the poster, I thought to myself, this looks a bit like it could be a bit messy. And overall, I felt the film was a bit messy.
Yeah.
And maybe that's to go back and say that if it was streamlined, if some subplots were almost honed in a little bit more, I think you could have a tighter, conciser film.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's my feelings on it. Out of 10, I'd give it 6.
Right. I wouldn't be too far off here. Probably be 6.5, 7. I think it was too aware of itself. Mm-hmm. One of the things we loved about the first one was that they kept trying to be cool and kept working out not to be cool. And at this one, it just felt like they thought they were cool. That over the top poster where everything is like day glow and blow person at the scenes, there's the other poster which you've probably seen where everyone's in black and white and they're just posing against the wall, and the tagline for the poster is just one word that says obviously, and it just is like, it's so try hard to be cool, and everyone's just like, yeah, I'm just like in the Guardians of the Galaxy, no BF, and you're just like, that's not what we came for. We didn't come to see you be cool. We came to see you trip up and accidentally save the world again. Like,
So out of 10, what are you giving, Rory?
6.5, 7.
6.5.
Perfect stuff. Rory Cashin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We love movies with Gordon Hayden.
Now, when We Love Movies, we are going to continue our blockbuster preview. This week, we're going to look ahead to some films we reckon might tank at the box office. Andy McCarroll joins me once again. Andy, straight out of the traps is Stephen King's The Dark Tower. We still haven't seen a trailer for this, Andy. I don't know if we should be worried, bearing in mind this is a very difficult series of books to adapt for the big screen. And I don't know what number they're at in terms of, is it number 6 or number 7 in the series that they're trying to bring to the big screen. But we've got Matthew McConaughey, Idris Elba, front and centre. But none of them have really been tested when it comes to big blockbusters. So What's your feeling on this? Do you think it might have a hope of doing the business, or do you reckon, oh, this is going to be a Stephen King dud?
It does. Like, on paper, you would think, like, a Stephen King adaptation with Matthew McConaughey, you know, big star, Idris Elba kind of just coming out as a big star as well, that this would be a no-brainer. But as you said, the book themselves will be probably the most popular Stephen King books, but they're not doing straight adaptations. It seems they're kind of picking and choosing between all the different books. And like you said, trying to just adapt one of these is difficult enough, because the Dark Tower series is essentially the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Now, this isn't just like adapting, you know, Iron Man or Captain America. Mm-hmm. This is like trying to adapt all of them at once. And wow. Then you kind of, when you start to kind of dig a little deeper, like you said, there's been no trailer footage out. The film is out in August. The only thing we've had, they showed a brief clip at one of the recent horror cons, which was not received very well. And the whole thing kind of seems like the last blockbuster that was like this, where we didn't get footage beforehand, was Fantastic Four, and we've seen how that turned out. Another thing to kind of take care of is that we associate, you know, Stephen King being this, you know, huge star, huge adaptations of his books. They tend actually not to make an awful lot of money. Like, only one of his films has broke 100 million, and that was The Green Mile. Now, the second most popular film is 1408, the horror film with Samuel L. Jackson and John Cusack. So it's not, you know, it's not like the Marvel films or DC comic book films where they're guaranteed, you know, this is going to make a lot of money. Mm. His films tend to make within the, you know, 30 to 50 range. And for a film that has a budget of, you know, 150 million and there's supposed to be a proposed TV series and at least three or four sequels to this film, like, it's a huge risk to take on something that, you know, could essentially fall apart from straight out of the traps.
Yeah, it is worrying that there is no trailer as of yet. We move on, Andy. Guy Ritchie, he desperately needs a hit, and his take on King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, will be with us in a few weeks' time. What do you make of the trailer and the casting of Charlie Hunnam?
I think the trailer looks very underwhelming, but I'm saying that now, every trailer of Guy Ritchie's films I haven't particularly liked, but all the films that actually, mostly with the exception of Revolver, turned out all right. Even Man from U.N.C.L.E. 2 years ago, I really, really enjoyed that. What would concern me is the casting of Charlie Hunnam, and he just has this kind of zero personality to him. Like, I think, you know, his befuddled accent is kind of a nice metaphor for him. He doesn't really, he's a man without an island, basically. He was good in Sons of Anarchy. I really enjoyed that. But he doesn't have the personality of someone who can carry a blockbuster. Like, the only other thing he's been in beforehand was Pacific Rim. And I don't think anyone coming out of that film was saying, you know, Charlie Hunnam was the best thing in that film.
Absolutely, Andy. Now, another man who needs a hit is Johnny Depp, because he's got Pirates of the Caribbean, and now over here it's called Salazar's Revenge or something like that, whereas in the States it's called Dead Men Tell No Tales, which I think is a far better title, even if it is a bit of a mouthful. This film, by all accounts, has cost $320 million to make. It's one of the most expensive films ever produced. Now, from what I gather, Jack Sparrow isn't going to be front and centre. He is going to be very similar to how he featured in the very first film. So almost in a co-starring style scenario, because they really want to get back to what made Pirates great, which was the Curse of the Black Pearl. So they're calling this a soft reboot. But I'm also seeing on one of the trailers, Andy, that it's the final installment. So again, with it being the last movie, do you think they can redeem the series? Do you think anyone still cares?
I think they're still going to make, like, these films make colossal amount of money. Like, the last one made close to $1 billion. I couldn't tell you one thing that happened in any of these films past the second one. Like, the 2, 3 and 4 just kind of washed over me, and they become one giant film. This looks very much the same. And like you said, the Johnny Depp, that character works better in a cameo role. If you have him front and center, you get sick of him. And that seems to be what they're doing here. But it seems like a bit of a mess from the off. Like you said, this is the last in the series, but they've also talked this is a reboot, like a soft reboot, and they're going to continue with three more films depending on how this does. So it seems like even straight out of the gate, they're not really sure what type of film they're making themselves. You've got Keira Knightley and Orlando Bloom coming back. Their careers haven't really, you know, gone into stratosphere since Pirates of the Caribbean. So them coming back trying to reboot their own careers as well as this film, it's not very interesting. It doesn't look any different than any of the other films. It just looks like, you know, a massive cash-making machine for Disney that people will go and see just because they're familiar with the Pirates movies.
I'm shocked that it's cost $320 million. Bearing in mind, the last big movie for Disney Jerry Bruckheimer produced was The Lone Ranger, and that was an absolute dud. And also, Johnny Depp's credibility at the moment, with everything that's gone on in his personal life, I don't know if the you know, how fans will take to him.
Yeah, he's doing a lot of those Kevin Smith. I don't know if you've seen, what was it, Tusk, where he shows up as a private detective and then he plays that role in Yoga Hosers. It's absolutely horrendous. It just, Donnie Brasco was on TV last night and it just, that was 22 years ago now, and it just reminds me of how good he was compared to the kind of weirdo parody of himself he's become now. I'd love to see him go back to doing those types of films that he's actually being challenged in, as opposed to, you know, throwing on a bit of makeup and acting effeminate and calling that acting.
And finally, Andy, Luc Besson, he has put all the chips in for Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets, based on, I think, a comic book series. Now,
yeah, it's a French comic book series.
Right, okay, so you've got Dane DeHaan and Cara Delevingne. No disrespect to them, but they're hardly movie stars for a film that has, Andy, I think you were saying to me, like, off air, it was like 200 million.
Yeah, this is the one I think is going to be the bomb of the year. This is John Carter, this is Jupiter Ascending, which it actually looks very similar to. It's just, the whole thing looks CGI. It doesn't look like there's any heft to it at all. Like, 200 million, like, Dane DeHaan, who I quite like, he was in Chronicle and he played Harry Osborn in the reboot of Spider-Man. Again, he's not a big star. He's someone who you'd see and if I go, oh, I remember him from, you know, and then try and remember where it was. Cara Delevingne, of course, isn't a huge star either. She was in Suicide Squad, or probably the biggest thing she was known for. It just does, like, you have unproved leads. You've got a story that's based on an obscure French comic. And big sci-fi, I'm sorry to say, doesn't really work in the cinema anymore unless you've got something like Blade Runner or Alien where people are familiar with it. A lot of people aren't going to take a chance on this. And I think the last time, you know, we had a big science fiction film that done well was The Matrix, and that was, you know, close to 20 years ago now.
God, so that's a lot. Yeah, so it could be in trouble. And I just think, as leads go, they're not the type of people that I would really be clamouring to get to the cinema to see in action. Andy, thank you so much for going through that. Some interesting choices there of films Andy reckon mightn't do particularly well at the box office. They could be this year's Crash and Burn blockbusters. Andy McCarroll, we'll talk to you next week.
Cheers. Thanks, Gordon.
We Love Movies with Gordon Hayden.
And that is We Love Movies to a close. On next week's show, Dennis Quaid, he'll be on chatting about his new movie, A Dog's Purpose, along with some of the films in his back catalogue, such as Inner Space. Plus, in advance of the release of Alien Covenant, we're going to be taking a look at all of the Alien movies to date and ranking which ones we think are the best and worst. Hopefully, Alien Covenant can right the wrongs of Prometheus. I have high hopes. The trailer looks fairly impressive. If you're a fan of the Alien movies, you do not want to miss next week's show. For me, Gordon Hayden, enjoy the rest of your bank holiday weekend, and I'll talk to you next Sunday on We Love Movies.